I hope you enjoyed today's deep dive.
Hello.
Why not
I'm
take
Joseph
a moment
Kasser,
and join the discussion?
Welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
Imagine sitting down to dinner and the very first instruction on the menu is to physically act out surviving a plague.
Right, yeah. Not exactly your typical dinner party.
No, not at all. You aren't just reading a historical account. You're actually required to taste the bitterness of slavery, dip your fingers into wine to represent blood, and like actively look around the room to see who among your family members might not have survived the night.
It is incredibly intense.
It really is. Welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to explore this really fascinating, multi-layered, and highly interactive document. It's an excerpt from a Chinese-English Haggadah compiled by Veard M.
And, you know, to really understand what we are looking at here, we probably first need to define that term for anyone who might not be familiar.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So a Haggadah is, quite literally, the guidebook or the script used for the Jewish Passover Seder.
Okay.
It dictates the entire order of the meal, the prayers, the songs, the stories that recount the Israelites' liberation from slavery in Egypt.
Right. But the specific document we are analyzing today is a pretty fascinating variation on that, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
It takes that ancient, established Jewish framework and layers it entirely with Messianic Christian theology.
Wow.
Yeah. And it presents this whole unified experience bilingually in both Chinese and English.
Now, before we dig into the actual plate of food, just a quick note for you, the listener. The source material today involves a complex merging of deeply held religious traditions and theology.
Very deeply held.
Exactly. So our goal here is not to endorse these specific viewpoints, nor are we, you know, taking sides on the theological claims presented in the text.
Right. This is strictly an analytical exercise.
We are impartially exploring the mechanics of how this document attempts to fuse these different worlds, cultures, and beliefs into a single dining room experience.
And the visual evidence from the source materials immediately highlights that fusion. I mean, we are presented with an image of a cedar plate.
It's very brightly colored, right?
Yeah, brightly colored, explicitly labeled Passover in English, but it also features Hebrew lettering right there on it.
And have those very specific compartments.
Exactly, molded compartments for very specific physical items. There's a spot for a shank bone, a roasted egg, bitter herbs, vegetables, and a sweet paste called cheroset.
And there's also that matzah pouch resting right beside the plate.
Yes, an embroidered pouch with bold Hebrew lettering and a blue flower.
Which, just that visual alone tells you this isn't a book meant to be read quietly in a library.
Not at all.
The cedar plate and those opening rituals act as what I would call an edible syllabus.
Oh, I like that. An edible syllabus.
Yeah, it lays out exactly what you are going to learn over the next few hours, but you actually have to eat it. It's a script for a communal physical performance.
It is. But to really understand that performance, we have to grasp the core paradigm shift this specific text introduces.
Right, the shift from the original meaning.
Because the traditional Passover Seder is anchored in historical remembrance. The text we are examining even quotes the book of Deuteronomy, where God declares, I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians.
Which is the foundational historical anchor.
Exactly. However, this specific Chinese-English Haggadah explicitly reframes the meaning of every single item on that plate.
It takes the whole architectural framework of the historical Exodus.
And uses it to tell a New Testament story.
Yeah.
It specifically points to Jesus as the ultimate Passover lamb.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the text doesn't, like, wait until the end of the meal to introduce that reframing.
No, not at all.
It happens the moment you sit down at the table. The very first stage direction given to the participants is to change their physical posture.
Right, pillows.
Yeah, the text instructs, tonight we sit on pillows in luxury instead of in fear and in slavery in a foreign land.
It's a very specific instruction.
I find that so fascinating. How does starting a meal that is supposed to be about remembering brutal, backbreaking slavery by focusing on luxury and pillows fundamentally alter the psychological starting point for the people in the room?
Well, it creates a stark, immediate contrast. By instructing participants to recline on pillows in luxury, the text kind of bypasses the passive memory of trauma.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and it forces the participant to embody the resolution of the story first. Mm-hmm. You are physically experiencing the safety and freedom of the ending before you even begin recounting the bondage of the beginning.
So you feel safe right out of the gate.
Exactly. It provides a physiological sense of safety, which ironically allows the participants to engage more deeply with the darker parts of the narrative later on.
And while you are leaning back on those pillows, you perform the first action, which is Kadesh, the lighting of the candles.
Right.
And the text departs from a standard historical blessing here, too. It pairs the candle lighting directly with the New Testament, quoting John chapter 8, verse 12, where Jesus declares, "I am the light of the world."
Yeah, and the text actually weaves that theology directly into the spoken blessing itself.
How so?
Well, the participants recite, they say, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, who has sanctified us through faith in Jesus the Messiah, the light of the world."
Wow. So within the first few moments of the ritual, the theological lens is just permanently locked into place.
Completely locked in. The light in the room is no longer just a festive marker. It represents a specific first century figure.
We also have to look at the sheer cognitive load of how this is presented on the page, too.
Oh, the layout is intense.
It really is. You have the English scriptures printed, and sitting right beside them are the Chinese translations. You read the concept in English, and right next to it is the Chinese text for John 8.12.
Yes.
Then, for the ancient blessings, you have the Hebrew words written out phonetically in English, like Baruch Atasa Adonai.
Right.
You are sounding out the ancient Middle East, interpreting it through first century Christian theology, and processing it through the dual lenses of modern English and Chinese.
Which is wild. But that layout creates a remarkably globalized ritual from a localized ancient tradition.
It really does.
It ensures that regardless of whether a participant is a native English speaker or a native Chinese speaker, they are anchored to the exact same theological premise at the exact same moment.
So the translation isn't just an afterthought.
No, it is built directly into the physical structure of the meal.
So having established the environment and the theology, the document moves into the physical interactions. And this is where the Christian overlay becomes undeniable.
Yes, with the hand washing.
Exactly, Ertetz. In many traditions, ritual purification is solitary. You wash your own hands. But this text redefines the act. It labels the hand washing as servant-oriented.
And the mechanics of the instruction are highly specific here. Mm. The participants do not wash their own hands.
What do they do?
They are instructed to pour water over their neighbor's hands into a basin, and then use a towel draped over their arm to dry the hands of the person sitting next to them.
That's very intimate.
It is. And the text explicitly links this awkward, intimate physical action to the Gospel of John, chapter 13, where Jesus washes the feet of his disciples.
It forces participation. You know, you cannot passively observe. You have to physically serve the person next to you.
Exactly.
Which leads directly into the next tactile ritual, which is yachats, the breaking of the middle matzah.
This is a big one.
Yeah. So there are three pieces of unleavened bread in that embroidered pouch on the table. The middle piece is taken out, snapped in half, wrapped tightly in a napkin, and the leader hides it somewhere in the room.
Right.
The text notes that in the traditional Jewish Seder, some might view these three pieces of matzah as representing the patriarchs, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
But this Haggadah swiftly discards that interpretation.
Right.
It provides a totally new rubric, suggesting that as Christians, the three pieces of matzah represent the Trinity: God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
I have to admit some confusion here, or at least a healthy amount of skepticism.
Fair enough.
It is one thing to eat a symbolic piece of flatbread, but taking the middle cracker, breaking it, wrapping it in a napkin, hiding it in a drawer, and waiting until the end of the meal to bring it back, that feels sort of like an elaborate theological magic trick.
It does seem like a stretch at first glance.
Right. How does the text justify forcing an ancient piece of unleavened bread to represent the specific narrative of Jesus?
What's fascinating here is how the document utilizes the literal physical properties of the ritual to map perfectly onto a chronological narrative.
Okay, how so?
Well, the text references Isaiah chapter 53, describing the Lord's servant being crushed and put to grief. In this framework, the middle matzah represents the Son.
Okay.
The auditory snap and the physical breaking of the bread symbolizes his death. Wrapping the broken pieces in a cloth napkin mimics the wrapping of a body in a burial shroud.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And hiding it away out of sight represents the time spent in the tomb.
That is incredibly specific.
It is. And its eventual return at the end of the meal as the aphikomen represents the resurrection.
So they have taken an existing tactile tradition, you know, breaking bread and hiding it for the kids to find later, and completely retrofitted the internal software.
That's a great way to put it.
They turned a simple game of hide-and-seek into a real-time physical reenactment of the crucifixion and resurrection.
It ceases to be a static symbol and becomes a timeline acted out in dough and linen.
It's wild. Now, following these silent physical rituals, the cedar demands spoken participation and sensory engagement, specifically with the darker chapters of the historical narrative.
Yes, the carpus.
Right. Mm. We transition to carpus, which involves dipping fresh parsley into salt water. The text explains that the green parsley represents life, but the salt water carries an immense amount of thematic weight in this document.
A huge amount.
It states that the salt water represents the tears shed by the slaves in Egypt, the salty waters of the parted Red Sea, and the tears we shed in the slavery of our sins.
And the progression of those three symbols is critical. It begins with historical trauma, the tears of the enslaved Israelites. It then moves to a miraculous geographical event, the parting of the Red Sea. Finally, it lands on personal, present-day spiritual trauma, the slavery of our own sins.
All in one drop.
Exactly. By layering those meanings into a single drop of salt water on the tongue, the text seamlessly bridges the gap between the historical figures of the Exodus and the modern person sitting at the table.
And that bridge is necessary for the next phase, which is the four questions.
Right.
This is where the youngest person at the table is tasked with asking, why is this night different from all other nights? Why the unleavened bread? Why the bitter herbs? Why dipping the food?
So the children are actively interrogated the strange behaviors of the adults.
Yes, and the answer to those questions leads straight into the 10 plagues.
And the text takes a moment here to point out that each of the 10 miraculous plagues correlated to a specific pagan false god of Egypt, demonstrating divine authority over them. But again, the learning is interactive. As each plague is spoken aloud, you know, blood, frogs, gnats, and so on, participants are instructed to dip a little finger or utensil into their grape juice or wine and drip one single drop onto their plates.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The visceral climax of this section is the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn.
Yeah, this part is intense.
It isn't just a messy countdown with wine on a plate. The text has a very specific stage direction. It says, at this time, would anyone who is a firstborn son or daughter please stand?
Just imagine that at a family dinner.
Right. Making the actual firstborns in your family stand up in the middle of dinner is an incredibly intense reality check. It rips you out of a comfortable reading of ancient history and forces you into a highly uncomfortable what-if scenario.
But the discomfort is the point.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The text specifically reminds the room that, according to the narrative, if a household did not have the blood of a spotless lamb painted on the doorposts, the firstborn inside would have died. By making the modern-day firstborns physically stand up, the Haggadah collapses thousands of years of history right into the present tense.
Because they're standing right there.
Exactly. If you are the one standing, you are acutely aware that within the logic of the story, your survival required a substitute. You are no longer reading about anonymous Egyptians and Israelites. You are looking at your own brother, your own sister, or your own child standing there embodying the mortal stakes of the narrative.
The stakes are literally standing in your dining room. It's brilliant, frankly, from an educational standpoint.
It really is.
Now, following the sheer intensity of the plagues, the deep dive finally transitions to the feast itself. We encounter meror and korek.
The bitter herbs.
Yeah. This involves eating the bitter herbs, typically horseradish, mixed with the sweet charoset. The text explains that the charoset, that sweet apple and nut mixture, symbolizes the mortar the slaves used to make bricks in Egypt.
So you are chewing on a literal bittersweet combination.
Exactly. Then comes the main course. The instructions explicitly state, we will be eating lamb to remind us of the Passover lamb, sacrificed and perfect Passover lamb, Jesus Christ.
So every sensory input is tied directly to the theology. You experience the stinging bitterness of slavery in your sinuses from the horseradish, the sweetness of the mortar on your tongue, followed immediately by the lamb.
Wow.
The theological message is being delivered through the digestive system.
Yet the meal isn't just defined by what is on the plate, but by who is noticeably absent from the table.
Right, Elijah.
Yeah, there's an instruction to set Elijah's chair. A place setting is left completely undisturbed. The text explains the traditional Jewish anticipation of the prophet Elijah returning to prepare the way for the Messiah.
Okay.
However, this Haggadah immediately links Elijah to the figure of John the Baptist. It quotes the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 11, where Jesus states, John himself is Elijah who was to come.
which introduces a highly complex temporal dynamic into the room.
Well,
the text asserts that Elijah did, in fact, come historically in the form of John the Baptist to announce the first coming of the Messiah.
Right.
Yet, it simultaneously maintains the physical ritual that might return again to herald a second coming.
And the text fully leans into that anticipation. It actually instructs the leader to say, let's have someone run to the door and peek out down the street and tell us if Elijah's coming this year. Is he there?
That's amazing.
It is a kinetic, almost playful moment injected right into the middle of this heavy theological meal. You send a child to look down a modern paved street for an ancient prophet.
It brings it right into the present moment.
It really does. And speaking of that tension between what has happened and what we are waiting for, we have to look at the Dainu.
Yes. The Dainu is a centerpiece of the Seder. It is a traditional joyous song, and the word itself translates roughly to, it would have been enough.
The traditional lyrics build a compounding sense of gratitude, going step by step through the Exodus story. Like, had he brought us out of Egypt, but not split the sea before us, Dainu, it would have been enough.
Right.
Had he fed us with the manna, but not brought us to Mount Sinai, Dainu. But this specific text alters the lyrics. It adds new messianic verses at the very end.
What do they add?
It adds, had he given us the temple, but not given us Messiah, Dainu. Had he given us Messiah, but not sent to us his spirit, Dainu.
Oh, wow.
So if the original song is about expressing gratitude for the physical, historical steps of liberation out of Egypt, how does tacking on giving us the Messiah and his spirit change the fundamental meaning of the word enough?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the text is dramatically moving the ultimate finish line of the narrative.
Moving the finish line.
Exactly. In the traditional context, the enough culminates in physical freedom, the reception of the Torah, and arrival in the physical land of Israel. It represents a historical and national completion. By adding the Messiah and the Holy Spirit, this Haggadah redefines the ultimate destination. The enough is no longer just physical freedom or geography. It is a state of spiritual completion.
Right.
The physical escape from Egypt is basically relegated to a prologue. The ultimate liberation being celebrated is the liberation from sin through the Messiah. The promised land shifts from a place on a map to a condition of the soul.
That is a massive shift, and that shift in destination perfectly sets the stage for the conclusion of the meal. We reach the phase where the hidden bread finally returns.
Safun.
Yes, safun, the finding and eating of the Ephikoman. That middle piece of matzah, the one that was broken, wrapped in linen and hidden away like a body in a tomb hours earlier, is found by the children and brought back to the table.
And the text deliberately pairs this triumphant return with Psalm 126, which is a song entirely about captives returning to Zion, filled with laughter and shouts of joy.
Which is such a contrast to the breaking of it earlier.
It's exactly. The theological payoff for the earlier physical setup is fully realized here. The solemnity of breaking and hiding the bread is replaced by the joy and laughter of discovery.
Right.
It is designed to perfectly mirror the Christian emotional arc, the sorrow of the crucifixion turning into the joyful surprise of the resurrection.
And then we arrive at Barak, the third cup, which the text designates as the cup of salvation. Here, the document directly quotes the Gospel of Luke chapter 22. Jesus holds the cup and says, this cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood.
Yeah.
The text goes even further, actually, adding a quote from the book of Hebrews, stating definitively that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins.
So by the time the participants drink from this third cup, the transformation of the ritual is absolute.
Completely transformed.
The wine is no longer functioning as a symbol of God redeeming the Israelites from Pharaoh. It has been explicitly and entirely reassigned to function as the communion cup, representing the blood of Jesus, establishing a new spiritual covenant.
Which brings us to the very end of the night. Nirtza, the fourth cup, the cup of praise. The text concludes with a phrase that has been a beacon of hope throughout centuries of Jewish history. Next year in Jerusalem, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim.
A very famous, very traditional ending.
Yes, but immediately, literally printed right below that traditional hope for a return to the physical city, the document pairs it with a quote from John chapter 14. Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also.
Wow.
So what does this all mean? We end with, Next year in Jerusalem, paired with Jesus preparing a place in heaven, it is as if they have taken a geographical map of the Middle East and folded it completely inside a theological map of the afterlife.
That is exactly what they've done. The earthly city becomes a dual symbol. It holds the geographical historical hope of the ancient tradition while simultaneously being overlaid with the heavenly eternal promise of the New Testament. The physical Jerusalem becomes a metaphor for the eternal dwelling place prepared by Christ. And when you look at the physical pages of this document, you see how seamlessly the compilers wove all of this together.
The languages, you mean?
Yeah, the Chinese characters representing a massive global diaspora, the English translation making it accessible to the West, and the Hebrew transliterations keeping the phonetic connection to the ancient Middle East. It creates a unified, globalized conclusion to a ritual that originated in a very localized, specific context.
When you step back and look at the whole picture, it is just a masterclass in the repurposing of symbols. We started this deep dive looking at a brightly colored plate of food.
Right.
But what we found was a deeply historical physical ritual, one rooted entirely in escaping Egyptian slavery, where every single sensory element has been meticulously reassigned to tell a completely different messianic story to a bilingual audience.
Well, it's quite an achievement.
The sting of the horseradish, the snapping of the matzah, the dropped wine of the plagues, the empty chair waiting for Elijah. No piece of the original hardware was discarded.
No, they used all of it.
It was all kept, but the operating system running underneath it was completely rewritten.
It really demonstrates the profound flexibility and power of interactive ritual. The physical actions remain identical, but the meaning assigned to those actions has shifted entirely.
And that brings it all back to you, the listener. This document is a powerful reminder of how human beings actually learn and retain information.
Absolutely.
Reading a text on a screen or a page is safe. It is passive. Your brain just kind of files it away. But tasting the bitterness of history, feeling the snap of bread in your own hands, having to stand up in a room to acknowledge your own mortality, acting out a story bypasses the intellect and goes straight to the nervous system.
When you physically embody a narrative like that, it ceases to be something that merely happened to someone else in the distant past.
Right.
It becomes a lived experience, something you have personally participated in, even if only in miniature around a dining room table.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to ponder long after this deep dive ends. We usually think of history and memory as fragile things, you know, data points that live solely in our minds or locked away in the quiet pages of textbooks.
Yeah.
But if a community insists that history cannot just be read, that it must be physically eaten, tasted, and play-acted across multiple languages year after year, how does that change what we consider to be the truth of the past? Does history only truly survive when it stops being information and becomes a physical habit?